A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking whether inflation is actually a deliberate feature of a well-functioning economy, not some recurring accident. If prices are always trending up, that creates a race where salaries either keep pace or your real income shrinks. And his core question is, wouldn't it be better if the standard was neutral inflation, 0%, so ordinary savers aren't constantly losing ground? It's a question that feels almost obvious when you say it out loud. Why do we accept this?
The answer that makes people uncomfortable is, we don't just accept it, we engineered it. The 2% target isn't some natural phenomenon. Central banks are helpless to stop. It's the number they picked on purpose, and they work every day to keep it there. The Federal Reserve explicitly states this in their monetary policy principles. They target 2% inflation as measured by the PCE price index. The Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee sets interest rates specifically to hit 2% CPI. This is not drift, this is design.
Which is the part Daniel's getting at, I think. If it's designed, couldn't we design it differently? Design it to zero.
To understand why the answer is, we tried thinking about that and it scared us. We need to start with the central bank's playbook. Because the villain of this story isn't inflation, it's deflation.
Which sounds lovely when you imagine your grocery bill.
And that's the trap. Falling prices sound like a gift to consumers. But the mechanism is brutal. When prices fall across the board, people stop buying things. Why purchase a washing machine today if it'll be cheaper in 3 months? Multiply that across every household and every purchasing decision, and demand collapses. When demand collapses, businesses cut production. When they cut production, they cut jobs. When jobs disappear, people have even less money to spend, so demand falls further. Prices fall further. And you're in a spiral.
The thing that sounds like a saver's paradise becomes a recession accelerant.
Worse than a recession. The IMF's framework on this, from their Back to Basics series, is blunt. Moderate inflation is a buffer against exactly this. It gives central banks room to cut real interest rates during downturns without hitting what's called the zero lower bound. If inflation is already at zero and a recession hits, the central bank can't push real rates below zero easily. They're out of ammunition. But if inflation is sitting at 2%, they've got room to maneuver. They can cut nominal rates, make real rates negative, and stimulate borrowing and spending.
2% is basically the policy equivalent of keeping a spare tire in the trunk.
And the Japanese experience of the 1990s and 2000s is the cautionary tale everyone in monetary policy has burned into their brains. Japan hit a deflationary spiral after its asset bubble burst. Consumer prices fell for years. They entered what economists call a liquidity trap, where even zero interest rates couldn't stimulate demand because everyone was hoarding cash waiting for prices to drop further. It took decades to climb out.
That's the thing, right? When we say Japan's lost decade, the word decade is being generous. It was more like two.
The human cost was enormous. Young workers entering the job market during that period never caught up on earnings. Lifetime income trajectories were permanently bent downward. So when central bankers hear, why not target zero, they hear, why not risk turning into 1990s Japan?
Let me push on that for a second. Because someone listening might say, Japan's situation was extreme. A massive asset bubble popping, a banking crisis, a demographic crunch. Is it really fair to say that targeting 0% inflation in a healthy economy would cause all that? Aren't there other ways to fight a recession besides negative real rates?
That's a fair question. And you're right that Japan had multiple overlapping crises. It wasn't just deflation, it was deflation layered on top of a banking system that was effectively insolvent and a corporate sector drowning in debt. But the deflation made every other problem harder to solve. When prices are falling, the real value of debt rises. A company that borrowed $1 million when prices were stable now owes $1 million in an environment where its revenues are shrinking because customers are paying less. The debt burden gets heavier even though the nominal amount hasn't changed. So deflation turns manageable debt loads into crushing ones. That's what happened across Japan's corporate sector. Firms that might have restructured and recovered instead spent years just trying to pay down debt, unable to invest or hire.
Deflation doesn't just freeze consumer spending, it amplifies existing debt problems.
And that mechanism isn't unique to Japan. Any economy with significant debt, which is every modern economy, becomes more fragile when prices start falling. Households with mortgages, students with loans, governments with bonds, outstanding. Everyone's debt gets heavier in real terms. It's like the economic gravity gets turned up.
Which brings us to the mechanism itself. Let's open the hood. Why 2% specifically? Why not 1% or 3%?
The 2% number has a slightly accidental history. It essentially originated with New Zealand in the late 1980s. Their central bank was the first to formally adopt an inflation target, and they picked 2% partly based on the analysis of the time and partly because it was a nice round number that wasn't zero. Other countries followed. But the economic logic that solidified it is real. At 0%, you're right up against the deflation danger zone. At 1%, you're still uncomfortably close. A modest shock tips you into deflation. 2% gives you a buffer. At 3 or 4%, you start getting into territory where inflation itself becomes disruptive. People start changing behavior to avoid holding cash. Menu costs become real, the tax code gets distorted.
Menu costs, the literal cost of reprinting menus and price lists.
Which sounds trivial, but at high inflation it's not. Think about a restaurant during a period of 10% inflation. They're not just reprinting once, they're reprinting every few months. And it's not just the printing cost. It's the managerial time spent deciding new prices, the confusion for customers, the awkwardness of constantly explaining why the pasta is $2 more than last time. Now scale that across every business in the economy. The friction is real.
I'd imagine there's a psychological dimension to that too. If prices are changing constantly, people lose their sense of what things should cost. You can't comparison shop effectively because the reference points keep shifting.
That's what economists call price uncertainty, and it degrades market efficiency. People make worse decisions, or they spend time and energy trying to figure out whether a price is fair that they could have spent on something productive. There's also something called the greasing the wheels argument. At 2% inflation, employers can deliver real wage cuts without cutting nominal wages. A worker who gets a 1% raise during 2% inflation has taken a real pay cut, but it doesn't feel like one. If inflation were zero, that same adjustment would require actually reducing someone's paycheck. Workers resist nominal wage cuts fiercely. The result is that zero inflation can increase unemployment during structural shifts, because firms can't adjust labor costs downward when they need to.
Inflation is partly a psychological lubricant. It lets the labor market adjust without anyone having to say the words, pay cut.
And the Bank of England's framework makes this explicit. By anchoring inflation expectations at 2%, they create a predictable environment where businesses and workers can make long-term contracts without wild uncertainty. The target itself becomes a coordination device. Everyone plans around 2%, and that very planning helps keep inflation near 2%.
Which is weirdly circular when you think about it. Inflation stays at 2% partly because everyone believes it'll stay at 2%.
Expectations are everything in monetary policy. That's why the 2021 to 2023 inflation spike was so destabilizing. Central banks insisted for months that inflation was transitory, supply chain noise that would fade. They were wrong. By the time they acted, CPI in the UK hit 11.1% in October 2022. The Fed had to raise rates at the fastest pace in 40 years. And once expectations unanchor, getting them back is painful. You have to induce a slowdown to convince people you're serious.
That's the part where the theory meets reality. Because that aggressive rate hiking cycle hurt borrowers badly. Mortgage holders saw their payments double. Businesses faced collapsing credit. So the buffer that 2% is supposed to provide, it works. But the cost of using it is real.
And that's the transition. That's the theory. But theory meets reality when we ask who actually pays for this 2% target.
Because Daniel's question isn't really about the mechanics. It's about the distribution. Who wins, who loses, and whether the whole arrangement is quietly tilted against ordinary savers.
The uncomfortable answer is, it is tilted against ordinary savers. Not maliciously, but structurally. Inflation is a regressive tax. It erodes the purchasing power of anyone holding cash or fixed income assets. If you've got $50,000 in a savings account earning 0.5% interest, and inflation is running at 2%, you're losing 1.5% of your purchasing power every year. Compounded over a decade, that's a meaningful chunk of your savings just gone.
Let's put a number on that, because I think the compounding effect is easy to underestimate. $50,000 at negative 1.5% real for 10 years. You're left with about $43,000 in purchasing power. You've lost $7,000 of real wealth just by holding cash. And you didn't do anything wrong. You were being responsible.
$7,000 vanished. And that's assuming headline CPI actually reflects your costs, which brings us to the next problem.
Because your personal inflation rate depends on what you actually buy.
If you're a renter in a city where rents are rising 8% a year, and you spend a big chunk of your income on food, which has been rising faster than headline CPI, your real inflation rate might be 4 or 5%, double the official target. The headline number is an average. Your mileage varies, and it varies in ways that tend to hit lower-income households harder.
Why do lower-income households systematically face higher personal inflation?
Because they spend a larger share of their income on necessities. Housing, food, energy, transportation, and those categories have tended to rise faster than the overall price level. Meanwhile, the things that have gotten cheaper, consumer electronics, flat-screen TVs, are discretionary purchases that make up a smaller share of their budget. So the basket of goods that determines your personal inflation rate looks very different depending on where you sit on the income ladder. The official CPI might say 2%, but for a working family renting in a tight housing market, their real cost of living could be climbing at 4 or 5%. The gap between those two numbers is a stealth transfer of purchasing power.
Meanwhile, on the other side of the ledger, who benefits?
Anyone holding fixed-rate debt. If you've got a 30-year fixed mortgage at 3% and inflation runs at 2%, you're paying back the bank with dollars that are worth less every year. The real value of your debt is shrinking. Governments love this too. Inflation erodes the real value of national debt. It's a silent, deleveraging mechanism.
Then there's the asset price channel.
This is where the inequality story really sharpens. Low interest rates and steady inflation inflate asset prices. Stocks, real estate, fine art, cryptocurrency, assets that are disproportionately owned by wealthier households. From 2020 to 2022, U.S. home prices rose over 40% in many markets. If you owned a home, your net worth jumped. If you were trying to buy your first home, the down payment you'd been saving for just got further away, and your savings were losing purchasing power at the same time.
You're getting hit from both directions. Your savings are eroding, and the thing you're saving for is getting more expensive faster than your income is rising.
It's a double squeeze. And the post-2021 period made this brutally visible. UK inflation peaked at 11.1% in October 2022. Nominal wage growth averaged around 6%. That gap, 5 percentage points, is the biggest drop in real living standards since records began. People got raises and still fell behind. The race Daniel describes, where salaries either keep pace or real income shrinks? That race was lost, decisively, by millions of workers.
That's the thing that I think frustrates people. It's not just that inflation exists. It's that the people who designed the system seem to have accepted that savers will take the hit.
I think it's less that they accepted it and more that they saw the alternative as worse. But that doesn't make it feel better if you're the one watching your savings erode. Before 2008, it was different. Savings accounts sometimes beat inflation. You could get 3, 4, 5% on a CD. Real returns on cash were positive. After the financial crisis, central banks slashed rates to zero and kept them there for years. Suddenly, the saver's penalty became structural. 2% inflation with near zero savings rates means guaranteed negative real returns.
That's a relatively recent phenomenon, right? For much of the 20th century, the ordinary saver wasn't getting punished this way.
If you look at the period from the 1950s through the early 2000s, there were certainly inflationary episodes where savers lost ground. The 1970s were brutal. But there were also long stretches where savings accounts and government bonds paid meaningful positive real returns. The post-2008 era broke that pattern. Central banks kept rates at emergency levels for essentially a decade, and even when they started normalizing, savings rates lagged well behind inflation. We normalize the idea that cash is guaranteed to lose value.
Daniel's question, wouldn't 0% inflation be better for ordinary savers, has a surface logic that's hard to argue with. If prices aren't rising, your savings hold their value.
I want to honor that intuition because it's not wrong in a static sense. The problem is dynamic. Zero inflation doesn't guarantee wage growth. You can have zero inflation and stagnant wages. That's been Japan's reality for much of the past 30 years. Prices didn't rise, but paychecks didn't either. And if a recession hits when inflation is already at zero, the deflation risk we talked about becomes acute. Savers might keep their purchasing power for a while, right up until the economy contracts, jobs disappear, and the value of their savings becomes irrelevant because they need to spend them just to live.
The defense of the 2% target is essentially, yes, it quietly hurts savers in normal times, but it protects them from something much worse in bad times.
That's the argument. Whether you find it convincing depends partly on how you weigh those risks, and partly on whether you think there are better alternatives that haven't been tried.
Which gets to something Daniel didn't ask directly but is lurking in the question. Is this whole framework just a historical accident we've locked ourselves into?
There's a real debate about this. Olivier Blanchard, the former chief economist of the IMF, has argued for raising the inflation target to 4%. His logic, the zero lower bound, is more binding than we thought, and a higher target gives central banks more room to cut rates in a crisis. Others, like Scott Sumner and the market monetarists, argue we should abandon inflation targeting entirely and target nominal GDP instead. Focus on total spending in the economy, not just prices.
Explain the nominal GDP targeting idea quickly.
Instead of saying inflation must be 2%, you say total nominal spending in the economy should grow at, say, 5%. If real growth is 3%, you get 2% inflation. If real growth is 1%, you get 4% inflation, which is fine under this framework because the spending trajectory is stable. The advantage is that it automatically accommodates supply shocks. An oil price spike that causes inflation doesn't force the central bank to crush the economy to hit an arbitrary price target.
It's more flexible, but it's also harder to communicate to the public. We target 5% NGDP growth doesn't fit on a bumper sticker the way 2% inflation does.
And central banking runs on credibility and communication. The 2% target is simple, it's understood, and it's been internalized by markets for decades. Switching frameworks is risky. If markets don't trust the new target, you could get volatility that hurts everyone. Imagine trying to explain to the public that inflation is allowed to be 4% this year because growth was only 1%. It sounds like an excuse. The simplicity of the 2% target is a feature, not a bug, even if the number itself was partly accidental.
Given all these trade-offs, what can an ordinary saver actually do about it?
This is the practical question, and I think there are three things worth keeping in mind. The first is the most basic. The best defense against inflation is not cash. It's diversified assets that historically outpace inflation. Equities, real estate, treasury inflation, protected securities, TIPS. Over long periods, a broad stock market index has returned something like 6 to 7% real after inflation. That's not guaranteed, and it comes with volatility, but it's the historical reality.
TIPS are interesting because they're explicitly designed for this problem. The principal adjusts with CPI.
They're not exciting, but they directly solve the inflation erosion problem for the bond portion of a portfolio. The second thing, understand your personal inflation rate. If your biggest expenses are rent, healthcare, and education, all of which have risen faster than headline CPI for years, then your real erosion is worse than 2%. That means you need to plan accordingly. The official number is a benchmark, not your reality.
The third thing?
Know that the 2% target is a choice, not a law of nature. It was adopted, it can be modified, and there's an active debate among economists about whether it's still the right number. You don't need to be an expert, but understanding that this is a policy lever, not just how the economy works, means you can evaluate arguments about changing it. When someone proposes raising the target to 4%, you'll understand what's at stake.
I think that's really what Daniel's question is driving at. It's not just explain inflation to me. It's why do we accept a system that seems to work against ordinary people?
The answer, I think, is that we accept it because the people who designed it genuinely believe the alternatives are worse. Whether they're right is a live question. The Japanese experience with deflation is terrifying from a policy perspective, but the post-2008 era, and especially the post-2021 inflation spike, showed that the 2% framework has real costs. It protects the system at the expense of savers, and it inflates asset prices in ways that widen inequality.
There's also something almost philosophical here. Inflation is a tool for managing a growth-dependent economy. The whole system is built on the assumption that tomorrow will be bigger than today. More spending, more production, more consumption. Inflation is part of the fuel for that engine. If we had an economy designed around stability rather than growth, the inflation question might look different.
That's a much deeper conversation, but it connects to something real. The tension isn't going away. With central bank digital currencies being explored, with new monetary tools like helicopter money getting serious discussion, the inflation debate may look very different in 10 years. But the core tension between stimulating growth and protecting savers, that's permanent.
Where does that leave us? If we redesign monetary policy from scratch tomorrow, would we still choose 2% inflation? Or is it a historical accident we're stuck with because changing it is too risky?
I think the honest answer is, we'd probably pick something similar, but not identical. The 2% number itself has a bit of path dependence. It stuck because it stuck. But the principle of having a positive buffer against deflation is sound. The real debate is whether 2% is the right buffer, whether we should supplement it with other tools, and whether we've been sufficiently honest about who bears the cost.
Because inflation isn't good or bad in itself. It's a tool. The question is who wields it, and for whose benefit?
Right now, the answer is, it's wielded primarily for systemic stability, with savers absorbing a quiet, steady loss as the price of that stability. Whether that's the right trade-off is a political question, not just an economic one. And it's one Daniel's question rightly puts on the table.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1910s, postage stamps from the Chatham Islands were printed using ink derived from fermented Nicao palm berries, which gave the stamps a distinctive purple-brown hue that postal historians now use to authenticate genuine issues from counterfeits.
The Chatham Islands Philatelic Berry Authentication Method.
I have so many questions, and I'm going to ask none of them.
If we redesign monetary policy from scratch, we might tinker with the number, but the underlying tension is permanent. Growth versus stability, debtors versus savers, the system versus the individual. That's not getting resolved. The best we can do is understand which side of the trade we're on.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want to send us your own questions about economics or anything else, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be here.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro. With text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.